Hello, everyone, and welcome to NWR Connectivity, episode 367. I'm your host, John Reardon, and I am joined, as usual, by Neil Ronahan.
I'm full of beans.
You sure are, and you always have been. Additionally, we've got Alex DeFritis.
I just woke up from a nap. You guys should be proud and honored that I'm here.
Do you have a weird work schedule?
How long was this nap? Like, it is 8 o'clock at night where you are.
Like, 30, 40 minutes.
Okay, power nap.
Yeah, power nap. Yeah, okay. Future Redeemed, the game we're going to be talking about, destroyed my sleep schedule, and I haven't recovered since.
It is, like, we're going to start off doing some non-spoilery stuff with Future Redeemed, and this is non-spoilery stuff. Is that, like, like, Octopath 2 was a game that I definitely stayed up late playing because I had the deadline. Future Redeemed, I had a self-imposed deadline of getting it done before Tears of the Kingdom. But it was also, like, a test to be like, all right, when that Zelda game comes out, I am going to destroy my life. If I do this for a couple nights, how is it going to do it? And boy, howdy. Shit. Like, this Zelda game's going to kill me.
The thing with Future, I told myself, and there's messages in the Slack where I kind of said, like, listen, I'm busy with doing these, like, Zelda lore videos. Like, I don't know if I'm going to really be able to do the Future Redeemed review. I don't know if we're going to do a regular review or not. So I'm not going to kill myself playing this thing for a review. And then I beat it in, like, a couple sittings.
Yeah, you killed yourself playing this game for the review.
Whenever I start playing Xenoblade, I, like, slip back into Xenoblade review mode, which is, like, if you're not playing at least 5 hours, what are you doing with your life? Aim for 10.
That's my concern with Tears of the Kingdom, is that the past couple Zelda games I've all reviewed. So, like, even my experience with Breath of the Wild immediately was like, oh, I gotta get the shit done.
Yeah.
Like, that was the stuff where it's like, I'm like, all right, I'm at, like, the 60-hour mark. I need to go beat Ganon because I need to put pen to paper. The embargo's in 2 days.
When I guess this will be coming out the day that Zelda comes out. Happy Zelda Day, everybody.
Yeah, I will not be playing other video games
until
inevitably I'm reviewing an Etrian Odyssey or a Super Mega Baseball. And then I'm like, shit.
Etrian Odyssey will come in the same day as Zelda.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. That and Super Mega Baseball on, like, May 12th will just be like, hey, guys. And I'll be like, fuck you.
And I suppose it goes without saying at this point, if you're listening to this, since there probably isn't a Zelda review up, that we won't have that early, but I will be reviewing it, and I will write a review at some point. But because we don't have it early, I'm not gonna, like, kill myself getting that review done. I'm going to enjoy the game.
Yeah.
So give us a little bit, and hopefully you'll still care when we get there.
Yeah, and maybe we'll have some organic stuff come up where we do.
Oh yeah,
that's not a review.
Yeah, I'm sure. Well, and we will certainly be talking about it on this podcast next week. So, yeah, tune in for that. And once again, I say this, and then come Monday, I'll be rolling credits. And the review will be out Tuesday. Like,
this is, I guess, like, it's stuff that I imagine people will be talking about how long they spent with the game. Like, because reviews will be up by the time this airs. And I don't think this really ventures into anything spoilery. But, like, the buzz that I have heard from talking to people who have played this game is that this game is way bigger than you might expect. So
I expect it to be fairly big.
Yeah. Well, I think it's just a little, maybe it's to the people that are like, it's just like the old map again. Like, it seems like they have done a lot of work to iterate on that map and add even more.
Yeah. I expect Breath of the Wild. I expect all of that content, but then added on top of that. Like, I expect a Breath of the Wild's worth of content added on top of the content for Breath of the Wild, which in my book is a substantial amount of content.
I think it might be in that ballpark. It's like, I legitimately have not heard any, like, specifics, but it's just like everybody's like, I expected it to be bigger than Breath of the Wild, and it has surprised me at how big it is.
My replay of Breath of the Wild was 2 months long, so I'm expecting, like, 3 months for Tears of the Kingdom.
That's what, like, so the strategy guide for Tears of the Kingdom finally went up for pre-order. I have a feeling I know why it's not coming out until mid-June.
Oh, Lauren's going to appreciate that.
Well, exactly. That was I told her that, and she's like, oh, that's perfect, because then, like, she'll have a month to just dick around by herself, and then we'll get that guide a month after the game comes out. But it's the kind of thing that, like, I didn't experience the joy that Lauren did as much of, like, using that book as a guide. Like, that I think that strategy guide that came out with Breath of the Wild, I don't even know the company that put it out, but it was just a really well done guide because they have like the fold out map that, and I know this is how Lauren played it because I think she talked about it on last week's episode. And also I saw her do it, was it wasn't necessarily like going in there to get all of the, like find out all the shrines. It was more like she would unfold that map and be like, there is a shrine in this area. I'm going to go over there and try to see if I can figure it out. And if it was something that she's like, I have no idea how to get this one, she'd look it up and be like, oh, it's the Blood Moon Shrine or something like that.
Yeah.
But it is like, I kind of like that, that, yeah, there's going to be guides online and stuff, but there's something about that tactile feel of having a guidebook for this game that, that I really enjoy. And I think it's having like a month with the game and then like going for that, completing every shrine-like thing that they have in it. I hope it's just a good guide, like the last one.
It's funny to me that we're talking about this in an episode where a good chunk of our listeners are probably literally listening to this while playing Tears of the Kingdom.
Yeah.
As we're like, I wonder about this.
You know more than
this.
Us right now.
Yeah. Well, okay. The actual topic of today's episode is Xenoblade Chronicles 3 Future Redeemed, which all three of us have played through. We're going to start with some spoiler-free stuff, at least some relatively spoiler-free stuff. We'll talk about some gameplay and maybe some early things in the story. And then we will move into the deep spoilers later on, but we will warn you before we get there. So, in a broad overview sense, what's you guys' just sort of gut reaction to this DLC?
It might be my favorite DLC in a video game that I've ever played.
Okay, so positive. Alex?
I'm struggling to think of a DLC that I like as much as Future Redeemed, so I might be at the same place as Neil. It's not like, I don't think it eclipses the base game of Xenoblade Chronicles 3.
I think it complements it very well.
I would agree that it's certainly, unlike Future Connected or Torna, I think it much more, surprisingly, it integrates itself much more with that base game, not in terms of like the actual like events, but it heightens the base game in a way that I was not expecting it to.
And I do think it has you could draw a lot of similarities, and I think you also see it in Torna, that like Torna was the blueprint for what they did with this, at least from a gameplay perspective, because it does the same thing that Torna does, where there's definitely learnings as far as like, oh, we made the base game and like, ah, here are some things that didn't work quite as well. And they also streamline it, where, you know, in Xenoblade 2 to Torna, you had the gacha blades, and then in Torna, you do not have that. Just like with Xenoblade 3, you have like that intricate job systems and the heroes, and in Future Redeemed, everybody just has one job. And I don't think, like, I think it's the kind of thing where it is a streamlined experience. Like, I took a long time, I did not hit the under on how long to beat with either of these experiences. And it took me about, I think it was 80 plus hours to roll credits on Xenoblade 3 and about 20 hours to roll credits on Future Redeemed. And like, I think they were paced well, although, as we'll kind of talk about later, I think kind of the post-game aspect of Future Redeemed, just as far as like grinding levels, like just does not seem enjoyable in a way that I think that experience of like, oh, I'm going to start like doing all the Ascension quests and everything feels a lot more intriguing in Xenoblade 3.
I do have some gameplay issues with Future Redeemed. There was a lot of carrot on the stick feeling with Xenoblade Chronicles 3, the base game, because of the classes. And I've said this before, but I'm a sucker for classes, grinding classes, unlocking all the stuff, having the classes synchronize with each other in fun ways. And having just the set, this is what your character does, and that's all they do. I felt like I learned the character, and by the time I had mastered them, I felt like I had my fill of the combat. And there was a point where I was just more interested in the story than the combat, and I switched it over to easy, and I just churned it out.
So I think I like the combat more than you, but I do agree that the driving force for me in the game, I mean, I don't even think the combat in Xenoblade 3 necessarily was a driving force, but experimenting with the different classes and seeing how people, you could get different synergies.
Mm-hmm.
Like that was a fun experience where I essentially I would sit on Matthew or Shulk, or if it was a tougher fight with like a unique monster, I'd go to one of the healers. And it got to a point where I just had a very, very easy rhythm with every encounter. And the drive for me was more, I want to see what's going on with the wackiness of the story. And also, exploration is very good in this game.
I did notice with this one that I was changing characters mid-battle more than I did in the base game. And I
did
think
that a ton in the base game.
Okay, yeah, I didn't as much. I mean, I would definitely, like, I might change a character, like, kind of going into the fight. Like you said, like, if it's a tough fight, maybe you want to land on that healer. But I didn't often change characters while I was in the middle of fighting. And I found with this one that I would constantly be like, oh, people are getting a little low on health, let's hop over to the healer. Like, oh, I need to draw, like, the attackers are drawing too much aggro, let me hop over to a tank and draw aggro. I was doing that a lot more actively in this, and I think what it was the job system in that, or the class system, in that I always knew what class everybody was. Like, whereas in base Xenoblade 3, I was constantly just working my way through the list, leveling everything up. And so I wasn't always totally aware of who was playing what role at every time.
Or even, like, what is the best way to weaponize this class, because it might be one that I didn't spend that much time with.
Right. I'd hop over into somebody and be like, oh, I don't even know what their moveset is right now. Whereas with this, because there is no class system and everybody's locked on one, I could hop into any character and immediately just know their moveset. Which, I'm not saying that's like, this is better than Xenoblade 3 for that. But it was interesting in that it just, it changed the way that I played. Because I don't, like, this is the first one where you're changing like that in, or the first, like, Xenoblade 3 was the first time they had the whole character changing thing in combat, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, because I think in 2, you could change characters, but once you were in combat, I think you were locked to one. But
yeah. So I will say that that element of it I found easier with the jobs just kind of locked down.
I do with the combat as well. I like the Unity system with it a lot.
Yeah.
There's also like that rhythm of trying to get break, topple, launch. Is that the combo?
Break, yeah, topple, launch.
Yeah, mm-hmm. break, topple, launch. But like having that, like that be your goal, so then that you can execute on the Unity attacks.
Mm-hmm.
I liked like trying to work, especially more powerful enemies into those positions, and then executing on that. Also, there is one of the upgrades for your X reader or whatever it's called that just basically tells you like, oh, now's a good time to use launch. Now you can use one of those special attacks. And it was just like, it was fun seeing a lot of the streamlined things that they definitely did going from Xenoblade 2 to Torna, but I think they were way more effective at refining the Xenoblade 3 combat to some extent, or at least making it like way more user-friendly and less convoluted, just by doing some of those like helpful things that you could tweak on or off, honestly, if you wanted to.
Yeah, the fusion attacks actually reminded me a lot of Xenoblade 2, where
yeah,
you would get those elemental things on the enemies, and then you could burst them using essentially a fusion. I don't remember what they were called, but you would team up with your blade and do a special attack.
Yep.
And this felt it felt like it wasn't till the end of the game that I really had a good handle on how those attacks worked in Xenoblade 2. This was like that, but just simplified way down to just being get them launched and then do this and it'll do a thing. Cool. Got it. Like very user friendly and easy to pull off, which I appreciated.
What did y'all think about the way unlocks, specifically character stuff, was handled?
I think, can see why people would hate it, but I loved it.
I commented in the review that something I always thought was cool about Xenoblade ever since the very first one, it's something that really attracted me to the games, was that you gain experience from just wandering around and finding places. That I thought was cool. This feels like that taken to just an outrageous level. And I could see an argument for this going too far, but the idea that you don't, that all of your growth isn't through combat, some of it is through exploring the world. I really like that idea. I will say that this felt like
it's too spread out.
It's too spread out. And like
I needed
a lot of the
Korok
things
seeds this idea, because I like it in theory, but in practice, I felt like I was struggling to even find
or
just art unlocks.
Yes.
I think a thing that bothered me as well is that you do get with the ether masts, which basically, like, in an area, you construct this device that would then, like, show you where different things were. However,
I made one of those.
Some of those things that you might... Did you never find one of those?
I made one near the end, and so I never actually made use of it.
Okay. Yeah, I found one in the Colony 9, Yesterdale, or whatever it's called.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I found that, like, I guess probably halfway through. But the problem with that is that you do that, and there's, like, stuff that just isn't accessible yet, but it's still marked by a question mark on the map.
Mm-hmm.
So I had a brief time where I'm losing my mind. I'm like, I am on top of this question mark. There is no higher or lower level. What the hell? And it was just that, like, in that case, I know one of the examples is, I think it was either near the end of the game or after the final boss that, like, oh, a high level unique monster spawned there. That was the question mark. So there was some fine tuning that I think they could have done with that. Even just making it easier to find, like, there is that sensor that you get, even making it like that a little more powerful. I really do like that as far as hunting for stuff, but I think there's a way that, like, you could have, I don't know, maybe do some kind of clearer map marking or let it be like, oh, I'm looking for affinity growth things.
Sure. Can you use, like, it like like the Chica sensor where you feed in a certain thing and have it tell you about that. Yeah.
Like, I think there was just a little bit of a disconnect there, even as someone who enjoyed exploring a lot. And I think by the time I reached the final boss, I did not have everybody fully specced out. I think I had Matthew and A were both, like, might not have had every accessory, but I had all of their affinity growth unlocked, all of their arts unlocked. And like, by after I messed around a little bit in the post game, like, I don't have that much left on the table to find. It was Nickel and Rex were the two that were, like, they're being like, come on, guys, give me some help. And I'm like, yeah, I'm gonna do it with the characters I use more, fellas.
I always felt bad for Rex because I inevitably, without thinking, just start going through my upgrades from the top of the list, and Rex always landed at the bottom. So, like, for the weapon upgrades, Rex was, like, three levels behind everybody else because I would get to him and then be like, oh, crap, I ran out of stuff. And then, like, I would forget to go back to those earlier areas and get more stuff to upgrade Rex. So I'd go back and upgrade again and be like, oh, crap, I still don't have the stuff for Rex. And so eventually, right before I finished the game, I, like, went back to the beginning areas and was like, okay, we're finding stuff to get Rex upgraded.
Yeah, for me, it was just that, like, I liked playing as Matthew. I think as far as, like, going into that, like, I mean, one, he hits like a truck, especially if you power up his stuff.
Punching is fun.
He is unapologetically the main character from Xenogears.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Yeah, he, like, really from character design to, like, his animation. He's just a punchy boy. It's like Takahashi just doesn't, he's just slowly making Xenogears and waiting for someone to stop him.
But yeah, I mean, I used Matthew and I liked Shulk a lot as well. It's a little bit of, I want to play a Shulk, and also I did enjoy using his character. And then I would go to the healers because the healers would be important. I definitely liked A more as a healer than Glimmer.
Mm-hmm. I was almost the exact same way, but I was like, oh, playing favorites. Like, I gave a lot of stuff to Shulk. But when it came down to it, I'm not sure if I liked playing as him. I'm really upset that they made him a tank, because when you're in a fight that matters, you either want to play as the attacker or the healer.
Yeah, I did find that I'd hop over to Shulk quite a bit just to draw. I feel like the AI isn't particularly good at drawing aggro.
Yeah, like, that's why, like, I would use Shulk a lot too.
The AI doesn't get that, like, okay, when an enemy starts focusing on a healer, just burn all of your arts. Like, just do whatever you need to do to draw the attention away. Don't casually sit there and wait for fusions to charge up. This game needs, like, the Final Fantasy 12 or 11, 12, whatever one like had the yeah, it needs a gambit system where I can go in and say, okay, if this is happening, then do this. Xenoblade needs that. Is there anything else that you guys want to talk about before we get into story,
the exploration
stuff?
So it's something that Xenoblade 3. Or I guess it's more like the, just how they do, because even with the finding the gem unlocks and the arts unlocks in the world, the way that you build up the characters is essentially by gaining affinity points, by doing things like finding places on the, finding landmarks on the map, beating enemies, you know, completing side quests, main quests, stuff like that. And then you would use those points to, you know, power up your characters. That's where the affinity growth is. They each have like their first batch of them are all unlocked. And then you have to use affinity growth unlocks to unlock their second and third. I did like, because it's something in Xenoblade 3 that as I got overpowered, I would just stop fighting enemies, which would, like, because, like, enemies would not be aggressive to me when I was way overleveled on them. But I would not fight enemies, so I would not get the unlocks from certain enemies, which made things like, yeah. I don't know, crafting gems a real pain in the ass. But that's why I kind of like that Xenoblade 3 Future Redeemed has that thing where you have to beat a certain amount of each enemy to complete it in the, like, the bestiary or whatever. The Enemypedia, is that what they call it?
Yeah, that felt very, like, Pokemon Arceus to me.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, it felt like the Pokedex, and I dig it.
That definitely, like, because I would scout areas and be like, oh, I have not, that's still got a yellow symbol on it. Let's go. Yep. We need to go fight them. And it would be enemies that, I mean, I guess I feel like a little bit like a monster because I'm going in there and being like, fuck you, Turkin, that's not being aggressive to me. I will end you now. But I like that from a gameplay perspective because it did get it where I would have a base amount of unlocks for different enemy drops and things like that. And it also just like, you know, was that carrot on the stick for getting me to explore the world more. And it is that could be an aspect of why I go back to maybe 100% the game. It's more that like the last leg, I saw how high some of the unique monster, high level the unique monsters are. And I'm like, that seems like a lot of grinding.
I could see myself like 100% in the collectibles and like the Collectopedia stuff. Yeah.
Because like looking for those enemies is fun because it is like I had that moment with the first area where I'm like, I've got like everyone except for two. What do I do? Mm-hmm. And one of them turned out to be a unique monster that didn't spawn until the end of the game, which that is a pet peeve of mine in games like this. Like Mario Odyssey always does that where it's something that really maddened me when playing Mario Odyssey where like I would be in an area and I'm like, before I move on, I want to try to do as much as I can. And there would be stuff that would basically be locked until I left and came back and the game would not totally convey that properly. And that's something that Future Redeemed does a lot, especially with those question marks that you couldn't do anything with for a while that would show up on it.
Yeah, they're definitely, it feels like they are expecting you to come back after you finish it.
Yep.
And which on the one hand, I like that there is new stuff to do after I'm done, but it'd be nice if the game labeled that somehow.
Yeah, I mean, it's also the kind of thing where it's like, well, I guess, you know what, I'm not going to go down this line. We can talk about it later. 'Cause it might be a spoiler. But maybe it's also because I did a lot of this before I even got to the final area and the final boss and everything. But there's just not that much to do outside of grind for stuff in that post game. Whereas I look to something like the base game, which has a tremendous amount of really interesting content that you likely either did not do because the Ascension quests are a lot or stuff that like just straight up unlocks at the end of the game.
So we're in this spot. We just did the Breath of the Wild episode, and I went back to Xenoblade, and I believe it was Matt's friend who brought up how they didn't enjoy Xenoblade or Breath of the Wild as much because they had already played Xenoblade X. I haven't played X yet, so John, Neil, let me know if I'm wrong about this, but I think you're the reason why I prefer Breath of the Wild's exploration over Xenoblade is that Xenoblade's world is an MMO. Like, it's an offline MMO.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't feel as living and breathing as something like Breath of the Wild. You know, you go out into the field and it's littered with a huge variety of enemies, but it's like those enemies don't feel like they're a part of the world. They're just wandering around, just like MMO mobs.
So I don't think you're totally off, but X is definitely different from the other Xenoblade games in that regard.
Yeah,
and that actually makes me a little excited to go pick that up.
I'm like if it weren't for Tears of the Kingdom coming out in mere days, I would be booting up X right now.
Yeah, it's not that cool. It does that particular thing maybe as well as Breath of the Wild, but it definitely does it better than a regular season. Like, there is a feeling of, like, you can, if you hang out in kind of the opening area of Xenoblade X, you're gonna realize that the giant dinosaurs are on a looping pattern in their day-night cycle.
Yeah.
Like, they're kind of Majora's masking it. But, like, they do move across the world during, like, you'll be out there and you'll see this, like, herd of dinosaurs migrating across the map going somewhere else. And so it feels alive, even though it's very scripted, but...
It is not to the level of Breath of the Wild with those enemies, but I also think there's... And it has been, like, damn near a decade since I've played X, but it's very memorable, very good game. But it's the layers and layers and layers of systems in X that involve a lot of, like, oh, go back to this area to do X and go over there to do Y. And, like, it's not necessarily, like, the world's totally changed, but you're a lot more engaged with specific aspects of the game in the game world than you are in other Xenoblade games.
There are instances where... Like, the one I can think of is in that first area where at some point there's a side mission to clear out this area and gather resources to build, like, a water purification plant out in the wild. And then once you do all that, like, that building is actually constructed there. And then that's, like, there. And then there's, like, new quests at that building. So the world does, like, kind of change as you're doing stuff, but a lot of that's hidden in side quests and not in the main storyline. Like, side quest, Xenoblade X is a game about side quests, which is why people hated it, because the story itself was not as interesting.
It is, like, Xenoblade X is a game to me that's a little Chrono Cross-y in that, like, it's the left turn for a game that people liked for a specific reason, and also it is a game that there are aspects of it that I can look at and be like, ugh, but it's just the totality of it all together is just breathtaking in how ambitious and weird it is.
Yes. Yeah, and it is absolutely, like, the idea that it does a lot of what Breath of the Wild did first is 100% true. Like, you will get, especially once you get the robots and you're flying around and all that, like, you do get that Breath of the Wild feeling of, I'm gonna go up to the top of this mountain, I'm gonna jump off it, and yeah, that's all there. Only there's no fall damage in X, because they want you to jump off shit because it's fun.
Do you have a paraglider? I guess your robot is your paraglider.
Before your robot can fly, it can glide. So, yeah, you kind of do.
I still love that it's like 30 hours for you to get a mech, and then the mech can't even fly right away. Like, what a wild game.
It's 30 hours to get a mount. Like, your mech is your horse, and that lets you turn into a motorcycle. Like, it kind of just says, okay, you've explored enough of the map on foot that now we're going to give you a way to move across it faster.
Yeah, I'm not trying to put down Xenoblade or X. I was just in that mind space because we had just done the episode.
Yeah.
I was thinking about why I prefer one's world over the other, because, like, Xenoblade's worlds tend to have more interesting geography, but the living element in Breath of the Wild is what attracts me so much to it.
I know that technically Monolith and the Zelda team already work together on Zelda, but I would love specifically the Xenoblade team and the Zelda team to work together, because holy crap, what would that game be? I want to play it.
And that is, like, it's one part before we dive into full-on spoilers, because I think we can talk at least to a degree of this. There's definitely a very spoilery way that we can talk about this, and we will later. But as far as, like, what do we want to see Monolith do after now that Xenoblade 3 is finished? They have done the DLC way before the end of 2023 that everyone made fun of last year. And I recall, I think, John, you and I were both like, if you look at how long Torna came out, like, it's probably going to be out, like, I don't know, 9 months after launch. And well, would you look at that?
People should listen to our podcast
after launch. But Xenoblade 3 is done. So Monolith is, you know, going to make more video games for the company that owns them. I think the obvious thing is please, for the love of God, we've got like a year or two left of the OG Switch. Figure out how to get Xenoblade X running on that fucking system. Let's go.
So, addendum to that. Figure out how to put Xenoblade X on that system if the Switch 2 is backwards compatible. If it's not, then wait and just put it on the next one. Like, I don't want, as much as I love Xenoblade X, it is one of my favorite games ever made. I'd really like to have it on a not dead system, at least for a little bit. So yeah, if it's backwards compatible, then like go for it, put it on the Switch. But if not, then hold off for the Switch too.
So it sounds like you guys don't want Project Cross Zone 3.
I mean, have you guys ever played Project Cross Zone 1 and 2?
I do want to. I've played a little bit of the first one.
They are wild. They're weird. They're incredible.
Yeah, not my thing, but like, they're something.
Yeah.
It's got Crom in it. I'm going to play it.
It's got everybody in it.
It's got Sagata Sanshiro, for shit's sake. Like,
it's a weird series. It's got Xenoblade characters in it.
Yeah.
It has Fiora, and I think it is
Fiora. Nice.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
There was a Xenosaga character in it.
Cosmos is in it.
Yeah. Yeah.
The only Xenosaga character that anybody knows.
Pretty much.
Should we formally give our spoiler warning? And
yeah, let's do it.
Okay. This is your spoiler warning for because of the nature of Future Connect or Future Redeemed. This is not just your spoiler warning for Future Redeemed. This is your spoiler warning for the entirety of Xenoblade, with maybe the exception of X, but even that might get brought up. So just don't listen to this ever, no matter who you are. Just turn it off. You're not ready. Okay, let's go. So basic story stuff, as far as how this makes you feel about how Xenoblade 3 ended. I've said many times that I think the ending of Xenoblade 3 is hilariously bad and unsatisfying and leaves most of the cast completely unfeatured. And the one cast member that it does feature, Noah, is left wildly unresolved. This doesn't necessarily fix that. Well, it kind of does in a post-credit scene. But what it does is it gives some value to that sacrifice by setting up this idea that you need to split the worlds to save Shulk and Rex. And that recontextualizing of the ending helped for me a lot. And then that final shot after the credits of the two worlds going back together just made me go, all right, cool. Noah and Mio are fine.
Yeah, I had an emotional reaction to the planet separating and coming back together.
Yeah, yep. I wish it was a little more direct, but I was fine
with it. I wasn't expecting to get anything, so the fact that Takahashi just sort of went, they're fine, I was like, okay, cool, that's all right, that's all I needed. I just needed you to tell me that, and now I can sleep. It had a more significant impact on the ending of a game that it's kind of a prequel to than I ever expected it to have. I was not expecting this to resolve anything in 3, and I was very surprised that it did. It doesn't resolve everything, but it makes the ending of 3 significantly better for me. Where are you guys on that?
My disappointment with the ending of 3 is not so much the story beat, although, like, we still don't know who Zed is at
all. Yeah, that'd be nice. We actually know...
I feel like we know less about him.
Right, the prevailing theory was that he was the origin computer, which he ain't, because that's Antos. So, yeah, we have no idea.
He thought the origin computer was Shulk and Rex, and then we don't see him ever again in future.
Yeah.
He does sit in a theater a couple times.
Sure.
And contribute nothing to the plot. But other than that, Alex, how did you feel about the ending?
No, like I said, the planets coming apart and then coming back together, I had a bit of an emotional reaction to that, especially after the credits where they're just recapping the entirety of Xenoblade. It felt so good to have that confirmation because, of course, like at the end of Xenoblade Chronicles 3, my assumption was that Noah was hearing Mio at the very end. But it felt good to just see that actually happen and to be able to assume that all of our characters that we invested in, they're going to be okay and they're going to find each other again. I also, going back to like the beginning of Future Redeemed, I really like Matthew and A. I like their relationship. Their chemistry is really good with each other. It's very neat to see A be essentially Alvis,
mm-hmm.
and to see her play off of both Matthew and then Shulk later on.
Yeah,
that was very heartwarming and nice to see. the little moment between A and Shulk before the final battle.
Yeah, they do a good job of leaning into that, like, because if you like go back and replay Xenoblade 1, Alvis, you never really get a good sense of what Alvis's end game is.
Right.
Like,
you don't know if you can trust him for a giant portion
like
of that
the game. Even once you are kind of working with him, like, you go every time I replay it, I'm like, boy, Alvis is kind of sketchy. So like leaning into that and kind of splitting Alvis apart from like the part you can trust and the part you can't, I really enjoyed. And yeah, I like that Matthew to me felt like a very non-conventional Xenoblade protagonist in that he reminded me of like Rhine or Lanz.
Yeah,
like he's that character type, but you're actually playing it. And I think that plays really well with Shulk and Rex, since they're obviously like, if you had Matthew be a Noah like character, like if Noah was in this game, you'd have three of the same character. And so it's nice to have him be something different. Rex is aged into something very different. And I like the way they've aged up both. Like Shulk hasn't changed as much, but I like the way they've aged up both of those characters.
Well, he's cosplaying as Dunban, which is very nice to see.
It's adorable. Yeah, his whole, even his moveset, just, he just feels like he's Dunban. I do think it's weird that that Shulk lost his arm, when the reason that Dunban lost his arm was because he wasn't fit to wield the Minato, but like Shulk is.
There's no explanation. Like, he's just missing an arm.
They fought Antos. They fought
That's right. He does have it before he fights Antos. Okay, you're right.
Okay.
That's what happened to Rex's eye as well. They both lost something.
Yeah, yeah. I know Rex, because I think Rex has that conversation with Glimmer at some point. I feel like the best thing I could say about Rex's age up, I'm not going to say glow up, because it looks like he got the shit kicked out of him. I like seeing his character here after knowing what he was in Xenoblade 2. And the best compliment that I can give his portrayal is that there was brief moments while I was playing this where I'm like, I should give that game a second chance.
Oh, no, that was the darkest thought that I had throughout this entire thing. Yeah. Was like, do I want to go back to Xenoblade Chronicles 2 and give it a second chance?
I mean, you could just throw it on story mode and just burn it down. I don't know. I think I'm the only person here, but I do still maintain that I think it's a fun game to play through.
The field skills, bro.
The field skills are a problem. Yeah, I wonder if story mode affects the field skills.
That's what I was about to ask. I didn't know if you knew. Now I might have to look into that, because I played it on
normal difficulty like a man.
I mean, that's what I tried to do.
Also,
well,
story mode wasn't there yet.
With Xenoblade 2, I think that I think I even had this conversation with you, John, as I was playing it, that I was like, should I? And I was like, field skills, and I still hate the map. But if story mode impacts field skills to a way where they're not as much of a pain in the ass, maybe I will try that game again.
Just give all of your characters a bunch of food and music boxes the whole way through the game, and they'll all level up their field skills, and it will all be fine. You just gotta start from the beginning.
From a story perspective, I heard you guys talking about Matthew and A. Like, I do like how Matthew is, like, kind of a dingus. And I think he's a really, because it is that thing where it's like he's got the heart of, you know, your typical Xenoblade protagonist, but he's got, like, the head of the dipshit friend.
Yeah.
And it's a really good fusion, because there is that, like, that hope and optimism. And also his, like, ridiculous accent and the fact that he says, I'm full of beans. I love it.
I really enjoyed all of the people from the UK that I follow on Twitter pretty much simultaneously within a 24-hour period going, yes, full of beans is a phrase that we say.
Yeah,
it is not made up for Xenoblade. Because that's the fun part about Xenoblade. You never know what is UK culture and what is totally made up for the game, because it all sounds silly when you're American.
Full of beans,
that could all be real, it could all be fake, we don't know.
I'm not
convinced the UK exists.
And it's also I love that whole bent too of like Matthew's so trusting of A, And A is just basically like, you dumbass.
Yeah.
I was alone. Why did you trust me? It's just like, and it's just that whole thing of like, it's that, that Spider-Man tendency of just like, well, I need to help a person. That's what I do. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like that relationship. And even, we haven't talked about Nickel or Glimmer yet. Like, oh. Fucking Shulk and Rex's kids. Oh. That they just, it's the way they dance around the, like, I like that they don't have the moment where like Shulk says to Nickel, like, I'm your dad, your mom's Fiora. Like, but they hint at it so much. And the yep. same thing with, you know, Rex and Glimmer hinting at, you know, one of his 15 wives that he's probably like, wait, who?
He okay, probably doesn't even one. Know. Yeah.
But and even like just the moments of Shulk and Rex talking about it and just like that having those moments where they're talking with their child and they can't really say it. And also, like, I mean, their parting gift at the end, which I know we're going to get to Matt's manifesto at some point. And I do agree that, like, I think there was ways they could have been more concrete about what happens to Shulk and Rex in that final cutscene. However, like, the emotional beats all work for me because it is that thing of like, they are trying to, you know, but I forget the exact phrasing of the Yoda thing in The Last Jedi of like, grow beyond. We want,
you know, the next generation. We are, but they, we are what they grew.
Yeah. And like, that's the element that I see Shulk and Rex doing that they're like, no, we need to trust them to be able to make the city and put us on the path to fix this shit. It's all like, all that stuff worked for me. Like, I loved the cast of six in Xenoblade 3. And yeah. As I was playing Future Redeemed early on, I was like, I like seeing Shulk and Rex, but I don't know if I'm going to care about the rest of this gang as much. And by the end of this DLC that I, you know, admittedly, I feel like they left a lot of meat on the table with each character. I love this sextet. Just maybe not as much as the original core six from Xenoblade 3, but definitely with a similar, you know, comparative amount.
Yeah, it feels like you could have spent... This could have been an 80-hour game. And it, I mean,
deep it's, in the it, systems and stuff. Like, what a fucking video game.
What it is, I mean, the length that it is longer than most games you will play. Like, yeah. It's the DLC for Xenoblade is the length of your average Naughty Dog game. Like, it's. It's insane.
I do want more 15 to 20 hour RPGs.
Yeah. Oh, it's great. Just being to like being able to burn through an RPG in a weekend. Like, yeah. That's rad.
I wish that Nickel called Shulk dad, but that's more like a fan yeah. thing.
Well, that's, I mean,
I want Shulk to have that.
We were talking offline about that. And the problem is they could like Shulk could go up to Nickel and be like, I'm your dad. And Nickel would just be like, what's a dad?
They would need to have that like, entire city whole, scene where yeah. they explain what families
yeah.
are.
Yeah. Yeah, no, honestly, the way that they handle Shulk and Rex's writing in relation to their kids is, like, surprisingly excellent.
It's
and,
really
like,
good.
Very wonderfully tragic. There's one line from one of them that essentially just says, like, well, we figured this was going to happen eventually. Like,
yep.
Like they're not in the system, but they know their kids are out there somewhere just yeah. dying and going through this cycle and over again. And they have to see that. And it's so well done.
But then they don't get to see it. They get to give them their power and they can live yeah. to be 80 or whatever.
Well, this is probably not their first cycle.
Based
on what we know about the time. That's yeah. There's some interesting question marks about how long Shulk and Rex have been outside of the system. And whether or not they're capable of aging. Yeah.
I like it that way.
Yeah, because they should both be a couple hundred years.
You don't need to tell me exactly what happened to those characters, just imply a lot, and they did yeah. that.
Yeah, and it's you know exactly as much as you need to know.
Yeah. Yeah, and there's enough breadcrumbs throughout there to give you the touchy-feelies. Yep. Speaking of the touchy-feelies, how great was it when you walked into Colony 9 and that music started playing and you're like, this is the fucking tower where they ate the sandwiches, there's Dunban's house, here's all these spots that you remember from Xenoblade with the old shitty gem machine with the the worst iteration of that fucking mechanic.
Yeah.
Just delightful. Every bit of that was delightful.
I still haven't done the side quest where they're like, let's fix it. And I was like, no. Like that, I hate that thing. We're not fixing it.
You get like another level up of the gems when you fix it.
That's not worth it.
Yeah,
Everyone will just be one gem short.
Gems. Bad mechanic.
Bad mechanic in the first one. Great mechanic in three. Horrible mechanic in one.
Better mechanic three, in three.
Three is great because three did a thing that so few games are brave enough to do, where it was like, well, you crafted one healing gem. I guess you can equip that to everybody rather than crafting six of them.
No, that is a good move. Once again, I'll say better. I'm not going to say great.
Right. And it also wasn't RNG based. Like, it was here's the recipe for a healing gem. Whereas the first one was like, I don't know, better make it vaguely green. Like, that was as close as you get. And then it's like, you just hope that Ryan and Shulk are good friends while they yell at each other in this very vague mini game about crafting gems. God, it sucks in the first one. Colony 9 is great. The kind of throwback areas throughout this seem to really favor Xenoblade 1. Like, the most you really see of Xenoblade 2 stuff is
you'll
be like, oh, these are some ruins from Tantal. Like, we forgot this was the only area we didn't use in Xenoblade 3, so Tantal.
I do feel like, I'm trying to think back to Xenoblade 3, and it would stand out more to you as someone who has fonder memories of Xenoblade 2. I feel like there was a little bit more slant towards Xenoblade 2 references throughout the base game.
It felt more even in the base game. Yeah, okay. Like you have that like entire segment of going through Uriah, like in the mines inside the whale.
Yep.
And there's a lot of other like not every area is that overt, like, but there are a lot of little areas you'll be like going through some corner of the world and you'll be like, oh, I know where I am. And, you know, you can see like the hand of the more ordained Titan off on the horizon. I loved that in this one, since it's earlier in the timeline, that you can just see the entirety of Mor Ardain, the big standy uppy Titan, just off on the horizon, which I thought was really cool. But yeah, it definitely leans more towards Xenoblade 1, which I was fine with. I prefer that one anyway. But yeah, it would have been cool to see a little bit more Xenoblade 2 in there just to balance things out.
I guess real quick, like how do we feel about the no Nopons in this game, and how
The issue with the Nopons?
So it's Daddy Pon was friends with Melly, implying that Nopon is the son of the Nopon from Xenoblade 1.
So Riku is the son.
Yes, he's the
of Riki.
Yes. Now, I don't believe he's not the kid that we've already seen. Well, okay, so that's the thing. He could either be the son of Riki, or he could be the son of Riki's adopted son that you are with in Future Connected.
Yeah,
because both of them were friends with Melia. So it's not specifically spelled out, I don't believe, which one it is. But yeah,
Riki has like 1,000 children. So
yes.
Yeah, it was, the odds were heavily in the favor of Riku being one of his kids.
But my general stance on the Nopon is that I'm waiting for the Xenoblade game where the Nopon have been this huge long con the entire time, and Takahashi just flips the switch and is like, guess what? I had a plan for the Nopon. Because the thing with the Nopon, and this comes up in the ending of Xenoblade 2, where you see like the evolution of all these different species, and you see every species in the game, and the Nopon are not on the list. They're in Zanza's world, they're in the Architect's world, they're in the Origin world, and they're on planet Mira. They exist across dimensions and space, and it doesn't make sense that they're there. And I need people to stop trying to make it make sense. Just accept that the Nopon are there. They don't follow anybody's rules. They just are. And it's okay.
And with that, too, it's he's the secret seventh founder. He made the lucky seven.
He's like the fifth beetle.
Yeah. He doesn't get a statue, but...
No.
I mean, neither did Nickel and Glimmer. Probably because they're like, shit, we don't know what these characters are going to look
like.
No,
they do have
statues.
Oh, they do? Oh, no, it's the other It's like they're fucking helper.
Panacea Lenka. And
yeah, Lenka yeah. and Panacea are the two that yeah. don't have statues.
They get replaced by Shulk and Rex because yeah. Shulk and yeah. Rex.
Yeah. Yeah, you're not going to not give Shulk and Rex a statue.
Yeah, which I do feel like that's just a conceit about, like, nobody's going to care about it. Everybody else is going to freak out when they see Shulk and Rex here. But it is also wild that the, like, the write-ups, I mean, and I guess it's like they had this planned before, but going back to that Founders area in the city in Xenoblade 3, it just basically tells you the plot of this game.
Yep.
Yeah. Well, that's, I mean, Torna did the same thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Where, like, there are literally cutscenes from Torna in Xenoblade 2.
Yeah.
Which is really cool because they use the same mocap. And so you can literally play them in sync and just flip between them. And, like, Adam's costume changes because they hadn't designed Adam yet when they made Xenoblade 2. But it's really cool. Okay. Should we read Matt's email for some to balance this positivity out?
Yep.
Okay. Matt Zwodniak of Nintendo World Report writes in and says, I'll say up front that I'm mostly happy with Future Redeemed because the gameplay is just as good as the base game and Xenoblade 3 is easily a high point in gameplay for the trilogy. The problems I had with it were mostly related to how compressed it needed to be for the scale of the DLC, and it was so nice to have a new section of the world to explore, they made it easy to do. I also need to give big props to Xenoblade 3 for making it so fun to play as a support unit, since dashing around the battle as Glimmer and A to strategically drop AoE buffs was how I spent most of the DLC. As for story, Future Redeemed is the point where I have to accept that I'm just not looking for the same kind of storytelling in Xenoblade as most people seem to be. I see a lot of praise online, both in the NWR Discord and from randos on Reddit, for the radio scene. We'll get to that in a second. Because of how deeply and explicitly it ties together the canon of Xenoblade and Xenosaga. I personally find this to be one of the most frustrating and disappointing scenes in the game. Nothing the radio says is mentioned again, and the scene between Matthew and Nael could have happened in any other location without anything needing to change. The reason this matters to me is that the story is making a lot of promises that someday something cool might come of this, but for now it's nothing but promises. Direct references to Xenosaga and Xenoblade X are given enough importance to distract from the main plot of Future Redeemed, literally distract, since it's difficult to follow two unrelated conversations at the same time, and we can only hope that it will pay off someday in a game that hasn't been announced yet. A piece of writing advice I once heard was that you should play your cards early, because then it forces you to come up with new, more interesting cards. Future Redeemed feels like the writers were teasing what cards they have in their hand and letting us know how cool it will be if they ever play them. This isn't the only problem I had with Future Redeemed, but we're already three paragraphs in and I don't want to make you guys read a full-length manifesto. Ultimately, this is the part I wanted to highlight because it's the biggest gap between what I want and what it seems everyone else wants, since the very first question I asked upon finishing was, how about the radio scene? In conclusion, fuck chain attack accessories that give the auto build button the right to choose battle manual volume 18 over strategy volume 19 when I just want to make sure I'm wearing the belt that gives you the best stat boosts. I literally unequipped an accessory by accident just now while checking the menu to make sure I got the names right, and suddenly auto build likes strategy manual volume 1 the best. Thanks, Matt.
Yeah, I agree with him on the chain attack stuff, but I found it more whimsical and funny than annoying.
Yes, the fact that the auto... I didn't realize that's what was happening, I'll be honest. I was just like, why don't I have this thing anymore?
Yeah, it took me a while to realize what was happening.
Yeah, as for the radio scene, which I will fully admit, and I was, like, I'm the guy that I think Matt would be annoyed about, who was super excited about that radio scene. Because for any, I guess, like, if you were, like, and I will agree to his point that it's hard to pay attention to both scenes that are happening at the same time. Yeah. And they're both subtitled, which is, like, there's a lot of input happening. But having the game, like he says, you know, it's that they're not even playing cards, they're teasing cards that they might play someday. I kind of disagree with that. I think this is the play.
Like, yeah, like this is like the Full House, bitches. Like,
yeah,
because it's also that moment that you talked about of going into chapter 5 where you just see, like, you know, fucking, oh God, what's it? I'm blanking on all the names. Colossus World.
It's Earth, I believe.
Yeah, it is just Earth. Yeah, yeah.
You fade up on a suburb. Yeah,
America.
Yeah.
But it just seeing that, and then at least for me with this sequence, it is that realization of like, oh, like this is where the shit began. This is tying into everything with the architect and Zanza and everything, which is what the entirety of Xenoblade 1, 2, and 3 and the DLC was all building towards, was yes. that moment. And yet, is it in the weeds? Yes, it is in the weeds, because Xenoblade 3 is a game that does not require, but definitely heavily leverages your experience with 1 and 2. Just like the ending of 2 wouldn't make any fucking sense if you didn't play 1 and knew the other half of that sequence near the end of 2. It does not invalidate the stories that are going in any of those other games, because I think that even if I don't like Xenoblade 2, the stories for 1, 2, and 3 also have an emotional through line that work through it without needing to know all of the timey-wimey interconnective bullshit that's going on there. But Future Redeemed, by its very nature, is kind of tying into all those things. They are making very subtle references to things that happened in 1 and 2 throughout, as they have the protagonists from these two games in it. This is not meant for a person who picked up Xenoblade 3 on a whim last year. Like, this is meant for someone who's knee-deep in all of this. So you get to this point at the conclusion of it, where you see that city, you make those teases to X and Xenosaga, and I think it was telling, and this isn't to be like, you know, having my own Neil-a-festo to counter Matt's manifesto. But it was like the initial thing of how, like, oh, it drops all the stuff about Xenosaga, when me, as someone who looks at Xenosaga and was like, I ain't got time for this. I was in that split attention with the radio scene, and they started dropping Xenoblade X references, and that's what, like, the Xenosaga didn't matter to me. It's just that outlining that connective tissue between all of these games that they've been making for the past 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that is like you said, John, like, this is the payoff. This is they might do more with this in the future, but this is the payoff.
Well, and I would also say that like this is not the first time that we've teased the Xenosaga stuff.
No.
And I realize this is the dumbest way to get canon, but like, I didn't make Xenoblade. But like, we know that from a model robot kit, we know that the conduit, key MacGuffin of the entire Xenoblade series, has suspiciously the exact same origin as the whatchamacallit from Xenosaga. That's the same exact shape.
That's some Kingdom Hearts level tie-in
bullcrap. Right, like they're right both, there. If you go and read the origin story for the conduit, you're just reading the opening cutscene of Xenosaga. Like, these two things have tied together already. Like, this is not new. This is the game coming out and saying in the game, like, these things are tied together, and Xenoblade X is tied together, and they're likely parallel worlds of each other based on where the conduit wound up going. I would argue that Xenoblade X is likely the events of them not having the conduit, of Klaus never getting it. But this is the payoff. And yeah, hopefully, like you said, they then build off that with more stuff, but like the game finally saying in game, yes, all of this stuff is connected. Like, that's it. That is what this has been building towards. Yeah. So for me, it worked great. I completely agree that it's a very distracting scene because you're trying to pay attention to two things at once.
I do think it's thematically resonant though, because,
oh, well, it does matter to what they're talking about. Yeah.
This is something that I picked up because I was listening to a recap from a YouTuber about the Xenosaga stuff so that I could understand the radio scene, because as hype as it was, I didn't understand 90% of it. I saw Saviorite and I was like, oh, I clapped.
Yeah.
But what's so cool about that scene is that Niall thinks that the world that she's in is a paradise, that it's the thing that that they've been leading up to this whole time. Like, it's going to be the thing that saves her from the war in Origin, but it's not. It's a world that is has human rights violations, that is on the brink of destruction, that is going to be torn apart. It's a lie. And Xenoblade, especially 3, but throughout the entirety of the series, is about creating a world it basically be creating a world that's built for the future, that not to looking at the past, not being held back by by a robot god or by Klaus or Zanza, but creating a new and brave world and fighting for it. And one of the beautiful things about Future Redeemed is, like, if they don't create the world then and there, someone down the line is going to do it. And it's that future looking optimism that I love so much. And in that moment, you know, Xenoblade Chronicles 3 is about rejecting the endless now, rejecting the present. In Future Redeemed, it's about rejecting the past, especially the past laid out by Alpha. And Niall needs to be broken out from that moment. But she doesn't understand the world that she's in as she is rooting for it, essentially.
Right. Yeah. You, as the person who has seen all these things, who sees, like, you know, even if, you know, if you haven't played Xenosaga, which I think is totally fair. I haven't played all of them. There's a shit ton of them.
Accessible.
I own all of them, but, like, I'm not going to get around to that. But even if you've played X, like, you know, they're talking about the Earth Life Colonization Project, which is the plot of X. And, like, yeah, like you said, they're. That radio broadcast is talking about people evacuating from Earth. Like,
yep.
And she just doesn't. It's so. She doesn't get it. She doesn't get it. And yeah. And so that's once. Yeah. I completely agree that, yes, those two conversations are not. It's hard to pay attention to. But what that radio is saying and what Niall is saying are.
In direct conflict with each other.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and they're supposed to be. And the fact that she can't hear it is super important. And it's so good. I teased this to you guys before you got to the ending, but I hit the beginning of chapter 5 and you go from, like, being on Prison Island and then it fades up to a random house in a suburb, and I just hit the switch home menu button and just kind of sat there for a second, like, okay, we've hit that moment in a Xenoblade game.
Yeah, it's the landmark Saturn of
exactly. Of I did also really enjoy that. I think it was set in the post-credits scene. I believe fades up to Saturn.
I think so.
Adorable little homage backwards. Should we talk about the actual ending of Shulkin and Rex and A going into Origin?
I'm not sure if I understand all of it.
I had to talk to you that... after it ended because I didn't, like, so I guess what it comes down to is that Alpha was inside of Origin. Alpha being defeated meant that somebody had to go into Origin to stabilize
it. But A wasn't enough, despite being literally Alpha.
I didn't find it that confusing, but apparently it was. And so I don't know if I'm getting it
lucky
right.
Lucky for you.
The fact that people found it confusing makes me assume that I must have it wrong. because, like,
I mean, when you explained it to me, I'm like, oh, okay, I get that. It's just, but I mean, I think that's something of a storytelling trope throughout Xenoblade, is that they do things in like, I think I'd rather have them underexplain things than overexplain it. But I think that this game in particular, and Xenoblade as a whole, sometimes underexplains complicated things.
Yes, Xenoblade 3, I think that's actually something I appreciate. I think Future Connected or Future Redeemed did a better job of explaining, like, that Ionios itself was literally going to cease to exist unless they split them apart. Because in the base game, you have these annihilation events, but then they go, oh, they're being used by this cannon. We'll just go defeat the cannon and stop the annihilation events. And so the base game makes you kind of think that you solved that problem. And so then the concept of why do we even need to get rid of Ionios, you kind of lose it. This game did a better job of explaining that. But no, I interpreted the ending as you defeat Antos. Antos was acting as, even though, like, technically I don't believe, well, maybe they were. I don't believe that the Logos and Numa Core were in the Trinity Core processor, which is the computer from the space station that's running Origin. I think Antos was essentially acting as the Trinity Core processor. So with Antos out, that means you're 3 short because you don't have the Trinity Core processor. So I think that's the logic of we need 3 people. And so then A, and I assume that based on the context at the end there, I'm assuming that that Rex and Shulk were pulled from Origin very early on by A, and that they're sort of existing outside of time, because that would explain why they haven't aged, despite the fact that if you kind of do the math on where we're at in the Xenoblade 3 timeline, we should be like at least a few hundred years in. So they should be very, very old and don't seem to be that old. And then that's why they're then able to give life to Nicol and Glimmer, is that they're essentially special. They're not there, because that's the thing. The other people that have been pulled out of the cycle, they still die when their term is up. It's yep. just that their children will be normal, whereas Shulk and Rex don't seem to work that way. So I assume that was something that A actively did to them that they were able to pass on. I really liked the ending. I thought it was, and it,
yeah.
it made me be like, yeah, I'm glad that we split up the worlds again so we could get Shulk and Rex out of there. Like,
yep.
Because they very down. Much imply like it's okay, we're not dying, you guys are going to save us.
Now this is where we get Xenoblade Warriors, and Shulk and Rex Please. Are going on a journey throughout time and space, tying in all yeah. of the Xeno games.
Emotionally, I like the passing down the torch.
Yeah.
The stuff that's said by Matthew and by Rex and Shulk. I like that a lot. I don't understand why three people need to replace one computer thing, but
yeah, like I think it's just underexplained. It's fine.
I accept it.
Yeah, and it's, you know, it is admittedly, it's not super clear. I don't know if I've got it right, but like the concept of...
Also, A says something about them breaking rules by passing out the like their blessing.
I assume it was A's rules that A set up when A pulled them out of Origin.
Okay, sure. I'll accept
that. That's, once again, totally just this, that's how I read it. I don't think there was any super divine ruling or anything that happened, but that's how I took it. I liked it.
I mean, it was definitely better than the base game as far as a conclusion.
Right. Everybody got resolved and we somehow managed to kind of...
Even if it's as much crap as we're giving the base game's ending, like, I'd still, like, shed a tear for knowing Mio. Like, I want those
right.
kids to...
Right. Well, yeah, you... The base
kids
game,
to be happy, like, damn it.
You do care about them. You know who the base game doesn't mention at all in the ending? Lance and Yuni and Taihan and Senna. And,
yeah.
Like, you're left with, like, most of the party is just like, well, see ya. Hope Noah and Mio are okay. Like, but none of the other characters get anything. Noah gets one brief scene at the end where he hears somebody playing a flute. And, like, maybe it's Mio, even though that doesn't really make sense with yeah. the logic of the game. But, like, fuck, maybe. Like, so this did a much better job of actually providing an ending. And this feels like an ending to that trilogy. Like, they could yep. go on, and I would be fine if they went on. But, like, it...
Just
this feels like at a point where I'm like,
go
okay,
ham. Yep. Let's do it.
He needs to find new gods to kill, or just make Xenoblade X2, please, for the love of God. You put a cliffhanger at it a decade ago. Please make a second one.
Seems like they set everything up to just remake or remaster the Xenosaga games.
Those or X. I mean, they kind of put themselves in a position where, like, they can segue into either of those. I'm honestly amazed that Namco especially hasn't seen this opportunity to just be like, oh, we should be remastering.
I mean, they
Xeno
just
Saga.
Were like, wait, Biden Kaidos?
Yeah.
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 They're like, that's the wrong game.
Yeah. Same with, honestly, with Square Enix and Xenogears. Though this, they haven't really tied into Xenogears yet. That'll be in a future DLC. I'm not sure how you do that. Well, does anybody have any final thoughts on Future Redeemed before we call this an episode?
I think I'm torn as to whether or not I want to see Xenoblade 4, if I want to see, like, Monolith do something new.
I do want another Xenoblade, but I don't need it to be Xenoblade 4.
Yeah.
Like, I'm good if this is the end of the Klaus.
But I mentioned it, I would stump hard for Xenoblade Warriors that features a bunch of characters yeah. from 1, 2, and 3, and has maybe some kind of ties to the other Xeno games or other Takahashi works.
There's enough weird parallel universe stuff already going on that you could do it yep. and have it be 100% canon without that much effort.
Yep.
Yeah, I'm not sure if I have a like any real. I just if they do the Xeno Saga stuff, I hope it doesn't take forever for us to get a 4 or whatever the next Xeno game.
Yeah, I feel like unless they're going to change up Xenosaga a lot, I feel like a team at Namco could do that, and you wouldn't need that much. Yeah. I mean, I don't think Takahashi was even really involved in the second one anyway. So, like, you wouldn't need that much involvement from Monolith to do them.
How about this? Make Xenogears again, but, like, finish it.
Just Xenogears Disc 2.
Well, I mean, that's what I definitely said it to John. I want what they did with Chrono Cross, but with Xenogears.
Yeah.
Like, get Takahashi back to kind of conclude the story, like Masato Kato got to do that with Radical Dreamers and having that little secret ending.
The problem is, if they remake Xenogears, like, I mentioned this when I was playing through it last year, like, Xenogears is just the same plot as Xenoblade 3. Like, to a hilarious degree of, like, names almost being the same. So, like, I think if you remake Xenogears, you might kind of wind up with Xenoblade 3. So that'd be odd.
I'm down for it. Let's go.
Sure.
I don't know. I just want to play it.
Be a good fit for HDTV. It's already got the right art style.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Well, all right.
Yeah, I think that's all I got. Just very happy that I'll get to that I got to play this and finish it before Tears of the Kingdom took over my life.
No idea why they rushed it out now. I feel like they could have waited, but sure.
Yeah.
We'll call that an episode. Thank you very much for listening. If you have any thoughts on this, or actually, okay, by the time of our next episode, some of you will have played some Breath of the Wild, so like send us in your thoughts.
Or Tears of the Kingdom.
Tears of the Kingdom, Breath of the Wild 2, the Breathening. Yeah, send in your thoughts on that, because we're going to be talking about that next week. Yeah, you can follow us on Twitter at ConnectivityNWR. You can email us at Connectivity@NintendoWorldReport.com. That's all the things. Okay, thanks. Bye.
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 This was made possible by our generous supporters on Patreon. Check out patreon.com/NWR for all the details.